evening and a good Chodesh. Before I begin, I just want to apologize on behalf of my wife, Dini, who very much wanted to be here, but one of our children last minute became indisposed, or a little bit more than that, so she sends her regrets that she couldn't make it to the reception. I'm actually a little relieved that she couldn't make it to the speech, because she's one of my toughest critics. So, if I'm speaking about what stories do we believe, if she asks, just say it was unbelievable. So our topic tonight is, what stories do we believe? From Medrash to Maisalach, a discussion of Jewish lore. A couple of years ago I said something, and I actually hadn't remembered that I said it until someone said it back to me. And on further reflection, I think it was a moment of lucidity. You might say it was the first time, you might say it was the last time, but I think it was actually a good adage. What I said was, Siyag la emuna shelo lahamin, which means a protective fence to emuna is not to believe. Play obviously on the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, Rabbi Akiva in the third pack of Pirkei Avos says certain things are a siyag to other things. Siyag la chachma shtika. The way to become wise doesn't make you wise per se, but it protects your wisdom, is to be quiet, to listen. If I'm always interrupting when people are speaking, I don't hear what they say. Siyag la chachma, protective fence to chachma is to remain quiet and listen. It seems to me that a siyag la emuna, protective fence to protect true emuna, the things that we actually believe in strongly and wholeheartedly, is shelo lahamin, sometimes is not to believe everything. And what I'd like to do tonight, I hope this will be a light presentation, I hope it'll be somewhat entertaining, I mean it to be, but at the same time, I also hope it will be, it's interesting, I'm teaching homiletics this year, so I explained to the boys the difference between what I call a general chizuk and a persuasive speech. First I made them do the first category and then the second, and I explained that a persuasive speech means where not everybody coming in would have agreed with you or would have thought of it exactly in that way. I get up and say we should study Torah, and I'm talking to an audience that studies Torah, it's chizuk, but it was, we wouldn't call it a persuasive speech. But if one of the boys said we have to study more diktuk, or we have to get more sleep, so we, you know, I told them each to take a topic that they want to convey to their classmates, so that's a different angle on it, and maybe the person, the listener coming in, wasn't thinking of it that way. So I think it should also be what we could call, at some level, a persuasive presentation, and although I hope it'll be light, my goal is actually to deepen our emuna, to strengthen our emuna in our Kodesh Baruch Hu and in our emunas chachomim, and give it the strength to withstand the challenges that life sometimes brings. In short, in a word, a lot of the stories we hear are Baba Mises. In fact, even the term Baba Misa is a Baba Misa. I remember being taught as a child, why do we refer to stories we don't believe as Baba Mises? Because Bubbies tell Mises, they tell Maisalach, and Bubbies tell stories that are not always necessarily accurate. And it bothered me for years. I was observing and I saw different people who were grandmothers, and their stories were not less believable or reliable than other people. Didn't do an actual study of it, but I didn't have the impression that Bubbies were more prone to telling stories that were of lesser accuracy than anyone else. And actually, as it turns out, the word Bubba Misa or Bubba Misa has nothing to do with your Bubby. She is definitely trustworthy and as believable as anyone else. In 1501, a man whom the scholars call Elijah Levita, we usually call him Eliyahu Bacher, in Venice, published a book. And at that time, you know, publication was not like today, and to publish something was an effort. And there wasn't so much literature altogether, and folklore was not that common. So he published a Bava Buch. Now, why was, or a Bava Misa, it was called. It was in Judeo-German. And it was basically the English romance Beavis of Hampton, which was an old story. So in Italian, the work had been translated in different languages. In Italian, apparently, Beavis is Buovo. This was actually explained to me by D. Dini's uncle, my wife's uncle, Rabbi Dr. Moshe Rosenfeld, who is a true scholar of all things Jewish, a big Talmud Chacham, and also a great expert on publication of Sfarim and on Jewish books. So this Eliyahu Bacher published the first Bava Buch, and it was folklore, it wasn't true. They weren't even Jewish stories, as certainly this one is a classic. So Bevis in Italian was Bovo, so when it was published in Hebrew lettering, so it was the Bovo Maisa. So that category, that genre of book became known as Bova Buchs, Bova Maises. So that's where Bova Maisa comes from. So I think we English speakers should probably say Bevis Maises. Leave it to Bevis. It's that's the background of Bova Maisa. So you can see that even Bova Maises are Bova Maises, and there's a lot to be learned from that. What I'd like to talk about tonight is really that there are two different categories of stories. And some that should be taken seriously in terms of their accuracy, and others that not, that make their way into our collective lore. And let's start with the stories that I would say we should not take too seriously. There are different reasons why stories can make their way into our common, quote, Maisalach, that are not actually accurate. In the worst case, I would have to say it's deliberate falsifications, sometimes stemming from some sort of pathology, which is beyond me, what motivates the writer or the teller. but I'd like to begin with, see, I'm doing show and tell. A lot of people told me they're not going to make it, they want to know if I'm recording it. I want to make them feel a little bit bad, so I decided I'm going to bring, everything's going to be show and tell tonight. But when I was in yeshiva, probably when Ari and many, a number of us were in yeshiva, a sefer came out, Chidushei HaGrach MiBrisk on Bab Metzia. This is Reb Chaim Brisker's Chidushim on Bab Metzia. Very nice cover. Miksav Yad Kocho from his holy manuscript. And this was very exciting. This sold like hotcakes when this came out. And it has a very big mavo. Mavo is an introduction, almost a quarter of the sefer. It's an introduction, a lot of stories and history about the different Rosh Yeshiva and Reb Chaim Brisker. So, of course, that's the more interesting part of the sefer for many people. So you open it up, and I was reading. I was gaining all kinds of insights and information. And I read a story here. Before I get to the story, I want to point out that the publisher writes repeatedly that it's become a problem that people like to publish books that say they have Toras Brisk, the great Chachmei Brisk, Reb Chaim Brisker, the Brisker Rav. These were great Lamdonim, and it's become popular. If you want to sell a sefer, so you got to say it contains some Toras Brisk. Kayom kemat v'nesa hadavar kiskula. It's become like a lashbachas mikcha. If you want to sell something, mechirasa shall say, if you want to make it better, letzayin b'sharo alatifasa, to put at the beginning, or in its wrapper, you have to put kiyesh bo mi'inyone brisk. It has brisker tyra in there, because everybody wants to be a great lamdan like Reb Chaim Brisker, or the Brisker Rav. And he says it's become a big problem because it lacks in accuracy. And he repeats this again, I even marked it here. Tishtapechna avnei kodesh barosh kol chutzos. He says, and he even alludes to the names of different books, and one of them I have here, Likutei Toras HaGriz, Hetikas HaShmuos LeBeis Levi. He alludes to names of different svarim that contain a lot of brisk. Brisk or tyre, it's a good way to sell something. You say that it comes from Toras Brisk, and this is a real problem. So he tells a story here that Rav Nosson Kamenetsky, Rav Shiva's brother, told him that Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky was in Muncie, and so Reb Nosson told the publisher of this sefer, he said, here's a story I have, it's never been published, you're publishing a work, you should put it into your sefer. Here's the story that Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky was in Muncie, where he lived the end of his life, and Rabbi Yashaber Soloveitchik from Boston, Yeshiva of Yeshiva University, came one time to visit him, and they started talking, and Rabbi Yashaber said, you know, politics ruins everything. Politics ruins everything in Jewish life. And you know, it was politics was why my father didn't get the position in Brisk. Reb Chaim Brisker had three sons, Reb Yisrael Gershom, the oldest, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, who was a Rav in Chaslavich, and then later became Reshiva in YU, and where son took over for him when he was nifter, and the youngest was Rabbi Yitzchak Zev, Reb Belvel, the Brisker Rav. He took over for his father. Reb Chaim was the Brisker Rav, and his youngest son, Reb Belvel, became the Brisker Rav. So here, Rabbi Yosher Ber Soloveitchik complained to Rabbi Yaakov, politics ruins everything, and politics is why my father, who was older than the Brisker Rav, didn't get the position in Brisk. And if it was like that now, that in those times, you can imagine today, politics is ruining everything. Yeah. And Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky responded and said, Zil ha'idna v'solamachar, go today, come back tomorrow, and I'll answer you. I suppose Reb Soloveitchik was going to fly back to Boston. I'm not sure exactly what was going to happen. But I guess he stayed overnight in Muncie, or whatever the case was. He came back the next day. Reb Yaakov showed him a sefer, and the sefer exists. It's a sefer called Ohalei Shem, which is an account of different gedolim in Europe. And it bears the haskama, the approbation of Reb Chaim Brisker. And in the Sefer, it lists different rabbinic families, different of the Gedolei Yisrael and their families. And it has Reb Chaim's Haskam, and he writes a nice thing about it. And in there, when it writes about Reb Chaim's family, it says the oldest, Reb Yisrael Gershon, who was a great Talmud Chacham and so on, Reb Moshe Sheyichya Kvar Nodom Afursan Lagon Metzivan, also Reb Moshe was known as a great Gon, Bahashlishi Hachi Nichbad, Reb Yitzchak Zev Shlita. And the third, the most Nichbad, the most Choshev, the greatest of the three, the Brisker Rav. There you have it, Reb Chaim's own approbation on a sefer that says that his youngest son was the greatest. So he writes in the sefer that Yaakov presented this to Yosher Ber Soloveitchik, who had to accept it, and he took it all in. And he writes, and from then on, Reb Yosher Ber Soloveitchik had new respects for his uncle. And in the footnote, he says, and look at the way he was maspid him. He eulogized his uncle after his uncle passed away. He said it was a famous hesped, a beautiful, beautiful hesped. It was written up. He gave a beautiful eulogy for his uncle, all because now he appreciated who his uncle was and that his uncle was the worthy heir to the seat of the rabbinate in Brisk because of Yaakov Kamenetsky showed him this sefer. Now, I mentioned it once in the drosha. If you're going to misquote people, you should misquote people who aren't alive. And if you're going to misquote people who are alive, you shouldn't publish it. And if you're going to misquote people who are alive and publish it, don't publish it in a sefer that's going to sell like hotcakes. Because, interestingly, this sefer came out, and we happen to have been learning some sugyas in yeshiva that were relevant to this, and I found it striking. My Rebbe had just, in shiur, explained what Reb Chaim held, and explained how the Chazon Ish argued with Reb Chaim. And I looked in this sefer, and so Reb Chaim holds A, and the Chazon Ish holds B, and I look in this sefer, and Reb Chaim holds B. And it has the same proof that the Chazon Ish has against him. Here, Reb Chaim said it himself. This is supposed to be a manuscript from Reb Chaim Brisker. In fact, he gave it to his son, Moshe Soloveitchik, when he went to be a Rav in Chaslavich. He gave him some of his Torah. So here, Reb Chaim is quoted as saying, or apparently wrote what he disagreed with elsewhere. So that was on my mind when an article came out in the Israeli Yated Ne'eman. I have it here. This is from Pesach time, Toshin Nunvav, 1996. I've been working on this talk, my friends, for 13 years. I can't believe we didn't charge an admission fee. If charge an exit fee, people, there's no other use actually for this, but this lecture. I've been waiting a long time. But Reb Nosson Kamenetsky writes that he was in someone's house and he picked up a sefer and he saw his name, so he started reading on, and he reads this whole story. Basically, he says, "I'll tell you what happened. I was in the publisher's house. I was looking for a certain sefer. He has a library. I was in his house, and I mentioned to him that I showed Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik is Rav Yosher Ber Soloveitchik's brother. I showed Rav Aaron Soloveitchik this sefer. The sefer does exist. I showed it to him. End of story. No Rav Yaakov. No Rav Yosher Ber Soloveitchik. No Muncie. The whole thing. He certainly didn't tell him to put it into this work. Furthermore, he writes, Ha'emes yishakol bar das ubar yadiyah hachi klusha b'historia. The truth is, anybody who has any intelligence and knows anything about the history, yavin shadvar meinam kitzurasim, knows that these things could not have been the way they were presented. And he goes on to explain what happened, that Reb Chaim Brisk had actually fought very hard and felt that his son Reb Moshe was very worthy of rabbinic positions and got him a position earlier in life. At the time when Reb Chaim passed away, which nobody had foreseen, he passed away at the age of 65. It was during the war, it was during World War I, and Reb Moshe Soloveitchik was elsewhere, the Briskerov was there, the Briskerov took the position, and he says, and people from the family have told me that when it was possible after the war, he offered it to his older brother, and his older brother turned it down, and that Reb Chaim certainly would have felt him worthy of it. So that whole story about the rabbinic position couldn't have happened anyway. But it is strange. I will tell you, this sefer you will not find on yeshiva shelves anymore, but storybooks by the same author are still around. They are in many, many libraries. When it comes to Torah, I should point out that a little while later, the actual manuscript was published in this volume. This is Baba Kama, Baba Metzia, Baba Basra, and it's this thick. This is just Baba Metzia, and it's this thick because there are whole pieces in here that don't actually exist in the original manuscript. The pieces that do have been changed and altered and added and subtracted. It's unrecognizable, but stories have a way, as the expression goes, it gets around the world before the truth gets its boots on. So some of the stories there are hard to understand. Another more common phenomenon, which is less insidious, is just the transposing of identities. When you hear a story about a Gadol B'Yisrael and you think you heard it about someone else, you did. And that's because usually the person telling the story is not trying to tell it for its historical accuracy. It's for the lesson there, and it gets confusing. It's interesting. A couple of weeks ago on a Friday night, I was dozing off and I was unable really to learn, so I just opened up a sefer and flipped to the back where they have the stories, and I heard something that sounded familiar. This is the Makar Baruch. This is one of four volumes from Rav Baruch Halevi Epstein, the Torah Tzimima, who had a phenomenal memory and a very, very prolific writer. He had a hard life, and he kept himself afloat by writing a lot. He wrote a lot of Torah, a lot of some of it is historical. So I remember for years already, I had been aware of this story particularly because it involves the following name. Here the Torah Tzimima is writing about the Netziv, his uncle, later his brother-in-law. Upam achas shol oso habalshin Yehoshua Steinberg, Mivilna. I know someone named Yehoshua Steinberg. Actually, when I read the story, I didn't, but the name Steinberg came up, so it caught my attention. So a linguist from Vilna once asked the Netziv. The Netziv was a great, great gaon, lumdus, psak, and so on. V'hispol nashal kishrona hagadol b'chol eila v'yomer eila. Basically, the linguist asked him, he said, I spend my whole day studying language. You spend your whole day studying Shas and Poskim, and your language is nicer than mine. He said, I don't understand it. If I can write nice, that's why I spend my whole day studying, but you're Netziv's master of the beauty, the way he expressed things in the Hebrew language. So the Netziv told him, I'm going to answer you, and I'm going to give you an insight into a pasuk. In Eshes Chayil, in the end of Mishlei, it says, Sadin Asasava Timkar V'chagor Nasna Laknani. She makes materials, textiles, sadin, and she sells them. V'chagor, the chagor is the belt, Nasna Laknani. She gives to the merchant. She sells the material, and she gives the belt. So that's if explained, when you buy 1,000 yards of silk, and it's rolled up, or whatever material, and they roll it up, and they put it in a leather strap, so you're paying for a lot of merchandise, so the strap gets thrown in for free. So he tells the whole story there, but there's somebody who was a small-time merchant, is watching these big merchants, and he looks at the bill, and he sees they're paying for all the material, but they don't pay for the straps. So he figures for his dime store, he's going to go get the straps. The straps are free here. So he goes in and he writes down, I want to order, you know, 20 straps, and they charge him for the straps. And he says, I don't understand. He said, the storekeeper answers. He says, these guys are buying a lot of stuff, so they get the straps for free. You want to buy straps, you got to pay for straps. And the tziv said, I'm working on the ikar of the Torah. I'm working on the meat and potatoes. So the other stuff, the spices, the straps get thrown in for free. You want to get caught up in the periphery of it, so you pay. You have to give time and effort and energy on the periphery of it. A very beautiful story. And it's certainly an insight into how we should approach Torah. It's just interesting, and there's nothing wrong with this, but I happen to have been on that Friday night, a few weeks ago, I just flipped open to the back. Sometimes in the back of Sfarim, they have short Maisalach Divrei Torah. So there's a piece here in the back of the Beis HaLevi. Somebody had a question on a Gemara in Chelek in the end of Sanhedrin. How did Chazal understand a certain drasha? And the Beis HaLevi gave an insight based on the wording of the Pasuk. It was an insight based on a subtlety of the wording. So here, this is Rishimas Talmidim Beis Brisk. So it says, Hispoel Ashoel Me'od Mitshuvazu. The person who heard this was very impressed with this insight. Amar LeBeis HaLevi, Tameani Al Kach. I'm amazed at this. Halo Ani Bal Diktuk. I'm a linguist. V'amar Al Zev, and I work on this all the time, and I never. So he told him the same thing. He told him the same thing with the smaller time merchant, the big time merchant, and the truth is, it could be that they both said it. It's just somewhat striking. The Beis HaLevi and the Netziv were co-Rosh Yeshiva, ultimately they split, but it was the same time. So very often there's a Vart that becomes popular and it gets attributed. So I don't know who actually spoke to the linguist. It's possible they both encountered linguists. It's just interesting, very often you see the same story cropping up, but this is not meant as history. But so very often you see the identities transposed. Another phenomenon that we have very often is where people have an inability to quantify someone's greatness. The Holy Yisrael are way beyond. It's like, you know, you tell a third grader that somebody's a great mathematician, so he'll say, can he add 1,000 plus 1,000? He doesn't have the concepts to quantify the person's greatness, so in my smallness, I project my own view of what's great, and sometimes the stories that result, or the distortions, are actually very diminutive. They're not a compliment to the gogol in question, but it's because of the person telling the story's inability to quantify the person's greatness. One of the stories that our first author was decrying, although I wouldn't put him in a better category, but this is one of the svarim that has a lot of stories about Chaim Brisker and the Briskerov and other of the Talmidei Brisk. So there's a heading here, His Amtus Hagrach Belimud HaTorah. The strong commitment of Reb Chaim Brisker in the study of Torah. Reb Chaim Brisker was an unbelievable gaon and had unbelievable commitment to Torah. However, so it tells the story that Reb Chaim Brisker started having headaches. Ad shelo haya breir el kachta l'rofe, had to be taken to a doctor. Ukeshelo ba'u l'rofe yobadak osa amar shelo roa shum ba'aya, didn't see any problem. He looked at his head from this side and from that side and couldn't tell what the problem was. Went to another doctor, same answer, another doctor. Ad shechlitu lelechas la'ezer rofe gadol mafursam shehaya Yehudi. They went to a great Jewish doctor. And he also did his examination, came to the same conclusion. I don't see what should be the cause of the problem. So he said, Ein shum eitza el lelechas im Reb Chaim habaisa veliros mahu osa b'chol rega b'yamama. We have to follow Reb Chaim around and see what he's doing wrong. Okay, the doctor's going to follow Reb Chaim Brisker around. Alright, so he went with him, he followed him from place to place. Then the next morning, Shachris, according to the story here, after davening, Reb Chaim would stand near the wall and close his eyes for a half an hour, or an hour, and matzmid es rosho lakir bekoach, which means he would press his head against the wall very hard. Okay, he asked him, what do you do during that time? And Reb Chaim answered, Ani chozer al mea v'chamishim dapei gemara kol yom bal peh. I review 150 daf of gemara by heart. I have no doubt Reb Chaim Brisker could review 150 blah gemara by heart with his eyes. I don't doubt that for a second. What I do doubt, though, is that the mind that could figure out and understand those 150 Balpeh couldn't figure out, and all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't figure out that Rechayim pressing his head against the wall. The truth is, there's another story. I thought it was in here. I didn't find it, and I felt it was Bittel's man to go searching. But I once read a story that said that Rechayim Brisker was once concentrating and learning, and he was leaning over his stand, and at the end, he said, "What are these weights hanging from my shoulders?" And because he didn't even realize they were his arms. People just tell stories that border on bizarre. These are not complimentary to Gedol Yisrael. They come from maybe the right place. And sometimes they are variations of accurate stories in the same... by the way, I don't mean this to be a comprehensive treatment of all of the stories that are distorted. We would be here till dawn at least. But it's just interesting. In the same book, it has Baruch Ber. You have a picture of Baruch Ber there? Are you supposed to be my... my picture man. Oh, by the way, actually, speaking of which, give me the... I wrote down a doctored photograph. You have the page on that?
Yeah,
oh. Speaking of accuracies, this is... actually, this is Rebaruch Ber. This is Rebaruch Ber Leibowitz, great Talmud of Reb Chaim Brisker, a great genius, the Kamenetz of Rosh Hashiva. In the book about him, here is a picture when he was speaking at a laying of a cornerstone for the new yeshiva. My brother-in-law pointed out to me that there is one head wearing a cap, as Yeshiva Bacham used to wear in those days, that is recurring in this picture. As a matter of fact, you'll see a house coat and that male head, and another house coat and that male head. Apparently, wherever there was a woman standing, they took it out and put on a male head. Presumably, all the grandchildren of all of those women said that they didn't want to be in this picture. I don't know, but it's interesting how it's only men here, although they're wearing housecoats. But anyway, the great Reb Baruch Ber Leibowitz. So it says as follows: it's told of Reb Baruch Ber that when Reb Chaim, his great Rebbe, was nifter, and actually, this is probably the newspaper article that they are. Referring to
422.
Thank you. Here we go. This it came out in the papers that Reb Chaim was nifter. Reb Chaim was nifter in 1918. So when Reb Chaim Brisker was nifter, so a person came to him and said that he saw in the newspaper that Reb Chaim had passed away. Baruch Ber lo hisyachis elov klal. Baruch Ber, who was so close to his Rebbe, paid no heed. V'himshech l'znai ki'ilu lo karam uma. He continued to conduct himself as if nothing had happened. Not that revolver whistle, but nothing happened. Then two people came to the door and said Reb Chaim had passed away. Oz hischil livkos. He began to cry. Was abel rabu hagrach. A few days later they came to him and said, you know, what happened the first time? And the Anayu, he answered, Lo matzina b'Torah inyinu musig shel ne'amanus shel iton. We don't find in the Torah that a newspaper is believed. So therefore, when they told me that they saw in the newspaper that Reb Chaim was nifter, Lo hisyachas elov klal. That is probably an embellishment. Actually, in this book itself, when it tells the story, it is well known Reb Baruch Ber had a tremendous aversion to newspapers, especially many newspapers at the time that wrote things that were anti-Torah and against the Frum community. In the introduction to the Birka Shmuel, which is his sefer, and the introduction is written by his son-in-law, it said that he would touch a newspaper with his elbow. He had a great aversion to the newspapers at the time. When it tells the story over here, it just says, when they told him they saw in the newspaper that Reb Chaim was nifter, lo nohag avelus. He didn't practice avelus halachically. Doesn't say that lo hisyachas elov klal. I think Reb Baruch Ber would understand that if it said in the newspaper that Reb Chaim was nifter, it probably was very rare that they had an obituary and a picture of somebody who was alive and well. So sometimes people take the story a little bit further than is actually accurate. Huh? Okay. It happens all the time. I remember being told when I was in camp a story about Rav Moshe Feinstein, that near the end of his life, Rav Moshe Paskin the Shai was giving a shiur, and he said, and that's what the Magen Avraham says in Sifkat and Kuf Beis and Shav and such, and somebody said, no, Rebbe, it's Kuf Dalid. And Rav Moshe became very nervous, and he cited a source, and somebody told him that he had cited the number wrong, and Rav Moshe became very upset. He opened up a shulchan and he said, no, it's Kuf Beis, Kuf Beis. And then he was relieved. And later they asked him, why did he become so agitated? And he answered, because when I paskin a shaila, I rely on the fact that I remember every single word of Kol HaTorah Kula, including Shulchan Aruch, including the numbers Baal Peh, by heart, and when you told me that I was wrong, I was afraid that I was losing my memory and that my psukim were not accurate, and therefore I was relieved that I still got it together. We should all be zochet to a memory that's a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of Rav Moshe Feinstein, but later in life, having come into more direct contact with many of the distinguished Talmidim, Felder, one of them, of Rav Moshe Feinstein, they will all tell you, Rav Moshe Feinstein did not remember every number of a sivkot in Shulchan Aruch. Absolutely not. Rav Moshe understood Kol HaTorah Kula. He remembered things because of his deep understanding of the Torah, how every sugya and shas and what the conclusion should be, and we don't do ourselves a service. Certainly a person means well when they have that type of hyperbole, but the truth is, if I'm a child listening to that story, that means Rav Moshe Feinstein is a being to which I have no connection, and there's no real point in striving to understand the Torah to the degree that you can paskin a shaila, because that's reserved for human beings who are essentially malachim. The Chazon Ish has a famous letter, part of it quoted here. In the Kovetz Igros Chazon Ish, he writes as follows. Daiti, the great Chazon Ish writes, it's my opinion, it's my das. Ki roi lamachzikim betaros Hashem ladas es gedola ba'ofyon ha'amiti. It is appropriate for those who take fast hold of the Torah to understand, to know the gedolei Torah according to their true characteristic. V'imhuter ladaber lashon hara al umen ba'umnusu. If it's permissible to speak Lashon Hara, if somebody asks, you know, I need someone to do a certain job for me, someone's an artisan, someone's a professional, is he good, is he qualified? So you're allowed to say, he's good at this, he's a little weak in this, if it's Latoelis, if it's not to speak Lashon Hara, but because it's relevant, you have to know if the person is qualified, if that's one of the instances where it's permissible to give a critical analysis, L'ha'isha darish alav l'tzarech, for someone who asked it for a real need, Almisha Taraso Umnaso Lo Kol Shekein. For a person where Torah is his umnus, is his craft, how much more so? Shemutar Laodia Lamachzikim B'Torah. People have to know. Utzrichim Ladas Kia Yedia Shalchach Me'adar Libam Umidasim Hein Hein Gufei Torah. And understanding that is understanding the Torah, understanding the different characteristics of Gedolei Torah. Mikol Makom Tzarech Lazeh Zahirus Yesera. But you have to be very, very careful. Upen Mishana Hadavar Bekutzo Shel Yud, lest you change something in iota, overstate the criticism or the analysis. Benimtza Motzi Shemer al Talmud Chacham, it should say, yeah. And he's saying something, a slander of a Talmud Chacham. But he says, but it has to be accurate. I was talking not all that long ago to one of the poskim of our time about a certain Shiloh where the poskim of a previous generation were split on what the halacha is. And he told me he feels strongly the halacha is like this one over that one. He said he understood these matters more deeply than he did. If we paint everyone as being the same malach, then you can't have that kind of analysis. The Chazon Ish said it has to be accurate, it has to be with the highest respect, and the Chazal tell us you have to be very, very careful, always with Lashon Hara, but especially of saying something that's inaccurate with Gedolei Torah. But they were different. There are strengths, there are areas of greater expertise, and that's important for us to understand. Additionally, it makes us strive more to be like them. Rabbi Yitzchak Huttner has a famous letter. It's a touching letter, an inspiring letter. In the Igros Iksavim, it's number 128, Kuf Chaf Ches. He writes, Ra'a chola hi etzleinu. It's an illness, it's a bad thing. Shekasher mes askim anu b'tzadeh hashleimus shagod alenu. When we talk about the greatness of our great ones, of the gedolim, hinenu metaplam b'sikum ha'achron shal ma'alasam. We talk about the end product. We talk about the last step. We talk about the finish line. Misaper manu al darkei hashleimus shelhem b'shoah she'anachnu medalgim al ha'ma'avak ha'pnimi she'eschol v'nafshem. We talk about where they ended up without talking about the process and the struggle they went through to get there. Haroshim shel sichaseinu al ha'gadola miskabel. The impression one receives is ki'ilu yotzu mitachas yad ha'yotzu b'komosim of tzivyonim, as if they emanated from the hand of the Creator in their full stature and with that characteristic. This is a line that people quote commonly. People speak about the purity of Lashon Shabbal HaChavetz Chaim Zatzal. Chavetz Chaim, the great purity of his Lashon, of his tongue. Who knows about all the struggle, the inner warfare, the stumbling, the falling, and the backsliding? Chavetz Chaim also struggled with it. If I just say the Chavetz Chaim was perfect from get-go, then I have nothing to emulate, nothing to follow. And he said, how much more so the rest of us? He said, we have to be aware of the process. So sometimes when we make it too untouchable, we don't do ourselves a service. So for these reasons, sometimes the specifics of a story have to be taken with a large grain of salt. In addition, we have some stories which simply are allegorized. Famous the story of the Maharal and the Golem is commonly accepted. The Maharal did many great things. The Maharal was a holy, holy person. But the notion that the Maharal made a Golem doesn't appear till centuries. He had Talmidim who wrote about miraculous things that he did and his greatness, and the Golem is not recorded till the Maharal passed away, I think, in 1609. It doesn't appear till the 19th century. The Golem. And recent scholars have written up that it seems that the story of the Golem and the statue and all the comics that the play that emanated from that it probably was made up. As a matter of fact, there was a great Yid, Rav Yudel Rosenberg, who was at the end of his life was a Rav in Montreal, who wrote not only Svarim but folk. He wrote Bubba books. He wrote Beavis books. The Jews should read Jewish literature. He adapted certain Sir Arthur Conan Doyle books. In fact, there's some funny anachronisms in some of them, and put them into Yiddish. So he made this story, but it was not meant to be a serious story. And sometimes, when something is allegorized, especially in our time, we have to be very careful with it. An interesting example of this. This is a copy here of the New York Times article from January 8th, 1943, terrible time for Am Yisrael. This is the story of the 93 Beis Yaakov girls. 93 Jewish girls and young Jewish women, the pupils and the teacher of a Beth Jacob school of Warsaw, Poland, chose math suicide to escape being forced into prostitution by German soldiers. According to a letter from the teacher made public yesterday. And the article quotes a famous story that became a very, very well-known and inspiring story. It's commonly accepted today. Again, this is not a scholarly presentation, but I happen to have here Rebbetzin Farbstein's two volumes. This is one of two volumes. This is a great work. Hidden in Thunder, B'Seser Ra'im, a story of Frum people's commitment and Mesiris Nefesh and Emunah during the Holocaust, and it's a very well done work with scholarship and footnotes, and it gives you a lot of the halachic background, some of the very difficult shailos people dealt with during the Holocaust. I happen to have this. I don't have some of the other scholarship on this subject, but she has a footnote here. She quotes the story, and she writes, and again, this is not her original scholarship, but today people tend to doubt the veracity of the documents, especially Chana Weiss's, that was the original, for various reasons. First, it is hard to believe that an organized group of Germans would plan a public action that violated the Nazi race laws. Second, it is highly unlikely that such a large group of girls could have been together in one place without there being any witnesses or written record in the ghetto, the mass burial. It would have had reverberations that it didn't have. Furthermore, the conditions in the Krakow ghetto do not match the description, and it is not clear how the letter could have been smuggled out to Jews during the Holocaust. Moreover, Beth Jacob alumni in the Krakow ghetto who survived the Holocaust knew nothing of the incident, have not mentioned it in their books. She has here To Vanquish the Dragon. She doesn't mention it. It's a book I'm sure some people have read. Did not know the writer and heard about the incident only after the liberation. Even Rivka Horowitz, who distributed the document widely when Beth Jacob was established among the survivors, now doubts that the incident took place. So she goes on to say this was a story that somebody wrote to be symbolic of the Mesiras Nefesh that people had during those terrible times. Thus it seems that the document was composed for literary and educational purposes. She has theories as to what some things may be Maramis to Y-93 and other things, but generally accepted that it was not an actual incident. In our time, I think it's important to be careful with this. Unfortunately, when we, Rahman al-Islam, live in a time where there is denial of such a thing, the fodder of Rishayim, who will deny the Holocaust, is to find one Nakuda of Shaka. That's exactly what they do. As all conspiracy theorists, they find one question. You can question things that are unquestionable. You know, if this is really your house, why are you sitting on a folding chair, not on the couch? So we have come up with a whole theory that's not really, you know. They look for something. So if you give them something that they can actually point to, and that's how propaganda works. So probably things like this should be downplayed. It's important for us not to perpetuate stories where there are people looking to scrutinize. We have so many stories of Mesiras Nefesh and Emunah in those times that are true and painfully true. There's no need to call on the stories that are allegorized. So probably better not to perpetuate that. So that's another category. However, while there are many stories that are told more for educational purposes or have been embellished or adapted, there are stories to be taken very seriously, and their accuracy, their veracity, very seriously. I would quote one line from Chazal that I think is the distinguishing point, and that is Chazi man gavra rabba de kamasir alei, which means see which great person is attesting to it. The Gemara in Brachas is a Gemara in Chulin like this. The Gemara in Brachas is talking about, we have a Mishnah that says one opinion is you only daven Musaf. Right, tomorrow we're going to daven Musaf, so one opinion is only daven Musaf with a minion. If you don't have a minion, no Musaf. The other opinion is no, you can daven Musaf even without a minion. So the Gemara sets out to prove which is correct. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, so Rabbi Yochanan says, Anira Isi is Rabbi Yanai, Ditzoli, Vahadatzoli. I saw Rabbi Yanai, he davened once, and he davened again. He was alone. He wasn't with a minion. He davened once in the morning, and then he davened again. So what was the second time? It was Musaf. Amar le Rabbi Yirmiyah Rabbi Zeira. Rabbi Yirmiyah says to Rabbi Zeira, V'dilma mi karlo kiven daite. Yeah. You witnessed an account. You witnessed a story, but maybe you're interpreting it wrong. Maybe the first time you didn't have kavana. Zalacha, we're not getting into the specific, but this is one of the sources where, from where we know that you have to have kavana betvila. Maybe the first time he wasn't concentrating. The Gemara, the Yerushalmi indicates that Talmidei Chachamim, at least in that time, had a harder time concentrating in tefillah because their minds immediately went to learning. The Yerushalmi says that the Chachamim said we have to give thanks to our spines for bowing in modim because our minds are already thinking about the Talmud, about the Gemara. So maybe he's a Talmud Chacham, maybe his mind wandered and he didn't have proper kavana. And he davened a second time because he did. Amar lei chazi man gavra de kamasit halei. If it were someone else, if it weren't Rabbi Yochanan telling me this story, I'd say you're right. Maybe he misinterpreted what he saw. But I think there's two essential words here. First of all, gavra rabba, a great person. And secondly, the kamasit, he's testifying. You can have a great person, but he's telling a story as a mashal, as a parable. So then maybe, I don't know the exact details of the story. But Rabbi Yochanan is telling you a story and interpreting the story. Rashi says, Rabbi Yochanan shehed al davar yofa dikdik. Rabbi Yochanan is telling you the story, he made sure to get it right. Shevishvil tefillah samusaf and haisen. The Gemara uses the same wording elsewhere. When a gavra rabba is kamasid, when it's coming from a great person, and he's saying, this is what happened, and I understood what happened there, and this is how it was, that has to be taken seriously. And therefore, of course, when Chazal tell us stories, it has to be taken seriously. Which brings me to the subject of Medrash, which sometime we could do a whole talk on Medrash, but just to touch on how to view Midrashim. And I want to mention one thing, Derech Agav. Midrashim have to be understood properly, and this is sort of a side example, but I was sitting a little while back with Rabbi Yitzchak Perman, Rabbi in the Yeshiva, and he told me a very interesting insight of his into a Medrash. We have in the beginning of Chaye Sara, Sari Menu is Nifter, Vayavo Avram Lespod Lesara Vilivkosa. Avram Avinu came to eulogize Sara and to cry for her. So we all know in the word Vilivkosa, to cry for her, the chaf is small. There's a small chaf. So the Baal Tura mentions it and has different interpretations. In the Sefer Maharil Diskin, Rabbi Yeshua Leib Diskin, his picture is also in this book, but we'll let the pictures be. But Rabbi Yeshua Leib Diskin, the great Rav of Yerushalayim, so he has a very short piece here. Chaf Ze'era, there's a small chaf in the Torah, you write the chaf small. Shoma Shemesa Bita Gamkein V'hayabocha Al Habas Gamkein. The word vilifkosa, to cry for, if the chaf is small, indicating maybe you shouldn't read it. So without the chaf, the word vilifkosa, to cry for her, becomes ulevita, and for her daughter. Avram Avinu heard that Sarah's daughter had also, his daughter was also nifter, and he was crying for his daughter as well as for Sarah Imenu. That's what the Maharil Diskin says. In a tshuva from Rav Moshe Feinstein to his student, Ephraim Greenblatt, great posuk from Memphis, Tennessee. He should live and be well. So he went to Memphis when he was a young man. Ilana knows Ephraim well. So Ephraim used to send many questions to his Rebbe. He left him when he was young. He would send many different questions. You have tshuvas that he asked about this, that, the other thing. So in Chelek Dalet of Aruch Chaim, Simen Mem Os Vav, a little part of a long tshuva, many different topics. Rav Moshe writes to Rav Ephraim, you asked me about what it says in the Sefer Maharil Diskin that Avram Avinu was crying for his daughter and that you saw that in Midrashim. Rav Moshe says, I never saw it in a Medrash, and it's, but the fact that I didn't see it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Avul hudavar shalacharu hudavar sheyafshar. He says, but it seems impossible. Why would Avram Avinu be punished for such a... it's not recorded in the Chumash. And also, it seems later that his daughter is alive, because the krava, the pasuk of Hashem Beirach es Avram appears later. That's afterward in Chayasara. And Rashi mentions he never saw this sefer. Interestingly, he said, "I never saw the Maharil Diskin on the Torah, but I'll take a look when I get a chance." So Rav Moshe says there's something strange about this medrash. Okay. Truth is, others do cite a medrash to that effect, but there's a Tosfos in Baba Basra Kuf Mem Aleph that says that Avram Avinu needed a shidduch for Yitzchak, and in those days they could marry siblings or have siblings. Tosfos asked the question, according to the opinion that Avram Avinu had a daughter, why didn't Yitzchak marry that daughter? And Tosfos doesn't really have an answer. So one of the Svarim, the Eliyahu Rabba, says, well, according to this medrash, that the daughter was nifter already at the time Yitzchak was in shidduchim, so we don't have the question. So Rav Perman pointed out there's a sefer, Rabbeinu Ephraim. It's not a common sefer, but if you have a membership to the online library that Irie and I have, I could get this in 1 second. It would be great. The internet has a lot of bad things, but something where this is incredible. As soon as he told me of this source, I checked it right away. That's the title page. And in Rabbeinu Ephraim, this is one of the great Rishonim, in his commentary on Chumash, it says, V'yesh mefarshim, Lachain he ze'era. Why is the chaf small? L'salka kamisha ani. He's supposed to take it out as if it's not there. V'yishara ulevita, and read it as his daughter. Kilomar, meaning to say, l'fisha hinicha bas she'adayin lo niseis habas b'chaye ima. Sari Menu is nifter, and Avram Avinu had a daughter who hadn't gotten married yet. Payavo Avram lespod lesar v'lefkosa al shalom niseis b'chaye ima. He felt fit for his daughter who would walk to the chuppah without her mother. It's a touching measure to cry for his daughter, not that the daughter was nifter, was crying for the daughter who didn't have a mother. It was a sad thing. It's a very touching Rabbeinu Ephraim, touching medrash. Moshe Bochim Alima. He says that's the pshat in the medrash. Very interesting. All the questions are answered. L'spod l'sar v'l'fkosa, to cry for his daughter, but not that she was nifter. So again, it's interesting. The Maharal Diskin had understood it the first way, but this is we have a source in a Rishon, sometimes Midrashim, because everybody quotes this, that Avraham Avinu lost his daughter at that time. Here we have from one of the Rishonim interpreted the Midrash differently. But that's just an interesting aside. In general about Midrashim, just to quote a couple very quickly, and I don't want to go over time, a couple of sources. Rabbeinu Avraham ben Arambam, the Rambam's son, who was one who explained a lot of his father's writings, has a famous Maimar al Odos Drashos Chazal. How do we understand the Midrashim of Chazal? And he says the Ma'asios, the stories that are told, fall into four categories. He says the first are things that happened, exactly the way they're written, and he has four subcategories of that. The second are things that were in a dream. He mentions some instances in the Gemara. He says the third are incidents that happened, but El Shadibru Behem Lashon Havai, but they were put in terms that are clearly, Havai means nonsensical, it's a strong word, but Ki Lo Yita Bal Sechel Shekol Sechel Shehem Divrei Havai. Chazal phrased it in a way nobody should think that that is literal. And he says that we have a Gemara that says that the Torah does that in places. It says in the beginning of the Sefer Dvarim that the Jews were afraid, and when we were recounting how they were afraid when they heard the report from the spies, from the Meraglim, cities built up at Tsuros Bashamayim, cities that are fortified to the sky. It says it can't mean literally to the sky. So the Gemara in Maseches Tambit says that sometimes Chazal said some things in an extreme way and meant as a guzma. That shouldn't be taken too far by that. It has to be understood. It doesn't mean you can always say that something is an exaggeration. Then he, by the way, interestingly, since we're bringing in the month of Purim, Rabbeinu Avraham ben Arambam holds that the story of Rabba and Rab Zeira, it says in the Gemara Megillah that Rabba got drunk and he slaughtered Rab Zeira. He says that doesn't mean literally he slaughtered him. When Chazal say he slaughtered him, it doesn't mean literally. There are others who learned it means he literally slaughtered him, revived him. But he says, no, that can't be. That's the type of place where Chazal said something in a guzma. But then he says, the fourth category, there are things that actually happened. It's 100% true, but you're not reading the right language. It's a mashal for something else. And he says, later on, he says, I can prove to you that sometimes Chazal say things that they don't mean literally. The Gemara tells a story where a Talmud, a student of Rabbi Elazar, was Mora Halacha Befnei Rabbo. He paskened the Shaila in front of his Rebbe, which is a chutzpah, which is an issur to do. And Rabbi Elazar said to his wife, I don't think he's gonna live. Velo hotzi shnaso, and he didn't live. She said to him, are you a Navi? Okay, and he said, no, I have a tradition that way. And then the Gemara says who he was. This is his name, so-and-so ben so-and-so. And the Gemara says, why do you have to say who he was? Says the Gemara, shelo tomar mashal haya. You shouldn't say it was allegorical. Says Rabbeinu Avraham, you see from that otherwise one might have assumed that, meaning that elsewhere something is not literal. Rosh Hashanah Fal Hirsch has a famous letter that he wrote to Rabbi Wexler in 1876, I think it was, and it was published almost a century later, but the letters existed in Ksav Yad for a long time, and he has, it's a very important letter to read about Agarita. It's interesting, somebody who couldn't be here tonight, somebody's in Eretz Yisrael, sent me an email and she wrote, I've always assumed I should just reserve judgment on how to interpret Agada, how to interpret the story parts of the Torah. I'm curious what you're going to say tonight. I wrote back, what I'm going to say tonight is that person should reserve judgment on how to interpret Agadas of the Torah. That's exactly what Rav Hirsch says. But I should quote, he begins by saying, and this was published in Hebrew, I have an English translation here, but beyond any doubt, the wisdom and the musa that Chazal, our sages of the Mishnah and the Talmud, presented us in their agadic statements and in their midrashim are incalculably great and lofty. That's Aleph. First of all, you have to know it's incalculably great and lofty. It's not, there's nothing that's without reason. But he says Nevertheless, Chazal put up a wall between these statements and halachic ones. There's a vast difference between halacha and agada. When you read Chumash, you read the guy I was talking to Ira about this a little while back. When you read Rishonim on Chumash, you'll read a Ramban, a Rashbam, an Ibn Ezra, a Radak. You'll see them sometimes say, Al Das Rabbo Seinu, Chazal interpreted this way, Vani Omer, and I say like this. Or Al Derech HaPshat, the simple understanding is like this. You will never see that. You will never see that in halacha. The Ramban will never say, you know, Chazal say we have 39 malachas in Shabbos. I say there's, that would be heresy. But Agarata is a different category. That's what Rav Hirsch explains here at a great length. He says, that's why Chazal say one does not derive halacha from Agadic statements. He says, I'm just running through it quickly here. On the other hand, some were expressed solely in the form of analogies, parables, or riddles. This category includes many agadic statements whose intent is not conveyed by their apparent meaning. He says, skipping a little, so before anything else, one must have great perception and vast erudition to know which agadic statement was meant to be understood literally and which as an analogy or a riddle. Listen to this. We possess no system for determining this. He says there's no one system to know what is literal and what has a deeper meaning. And as a result, we cannot derive any halachic matter from the Agoda. It is impossible to cite an agadic statement as incontrovertible evidence. Because what one person understands, he says that's why Chazal said that we don't derive halacha from Agoda. He quotes Rishonim to that effect. All the above statement protects God's community from the danger or error of errors by preventing every individual from interpreting Chazal's Agadas according to his own imagination, and then regarding his own interpretations as if they had been given at Sinai. Okay, so that's Rav Hirsch in a nutshell. The Maharal, the great Maharal, wrote a Sefer Ber HaGola, and for people who know a little bit the history, the Maharal was actually very vehemently opposing other writings. There was Sefer Ma'ari Nayim, or Azariah de Rossi, or Azariah Min HaAdomim, as we call him, Min HaAdomim, who wrote a work which was very controversial. Maharal and many other Gedolei Olam felt it was absolutely an unacceptable work, and the Maharal is coming to dispute his interpretations of many of the statements in Agoda. But the Maharal himself says that the Agadas have non-literal meanings. His main, and this is more than we could summarize here, but his main issue with the author whom he's disputing is the Maharal is trying to tell us that there's no statement that doesn't have a very specific meaning. It's just that the specific meaning might be in a different realm. It's not in the physical realm. One of the famous things he quotes is the Chazal that says that Titus HaRasha, the evil Titus, the end of his life, so a mosquito went into his nose and ended up as a bird, when the Gemara describes the claws and so on, and that's how he suffered his fate. And without going through the whole statement of Chazal, it's a Gemara that we read usually Tisha B'Av time, the Gemara in the fifth parak of Gittin. The Maharal says that every element of that story has a very specific meaning. And frankly, I would quote it to you, but I don't understand it. I don't understand his interpretation. But he explains what everything means. And it's not even symbolism. It means something in other realms, but these are realms. The Maharal understood Kabbalah, understood many things. He says at the end, V'al tomra ki perish ze yotze min pshat divrei chachamim. Don't say that this is leaving the simple meaning of what the Chazal said. Sha pshat hu al yitush gomer chamris. He said, "No, v'chol advarim k'mashman. Everything is as it says. Ki davar zeh hu mifal hadimyon. Aval mishi yesh bo das v'chachma shiodeya ki kol advarim heim be'inyan hamahus." There's a deeper level of existence, and it's talking about at that level. And at that level, all of those words that Chazal say mean something very specific. The Rambam himself writes that. He says, "If you don't understand an agarata, it's because you're backwards. It's because you don't get it. It's not that the statement of Chazal is backward. It has a very specific meaning, but it doesn't mean necessarily a literal meaning." And that's something very important for us to understand. So yeah, when it comes to the literal level of when Chazal says something, it was just today, just a few hours ago, I was teaching students about the story of David and Bathsheba. Here's an example, and it's a rare example, of where you have a slight difference of opinion as to whether when Chazal said something they meant it absolutely as an ikr, as an axiomatic statement, or if it falls into the realm of drash, of medrash. Most Rishonim say when Chazal said Kola Omer David Chata Eino Ela Toa, if you read the psukim at their simple level, it sounds like David HaMelech was involved in the Chait of Eishes Ish. Chazal say, our sages say, a person who says that is nothing but a mistaken person. Most Rishonim, if you look at all the classic Mefarshim, will say that they meant that. That's not a medrash, that's not one Chacham's interpretation, or that's not one level of meaning. That's a statement of belief. That the Abarbanel, the great Abarbanel, says no, David HaMelech actually fell to that level of chet, but did a tremendous tshuva, and maybe the reason would be there's a chazal that says that Hashem brought David to such a chet, so any person in the future who seeks to do tshuva wouldn't be discouraged. There could be reason, but he actually interprets it. No, that's one way of understanding it, but it doesn't have to be that way. The Malbim cites many proofs, and frankly they're very convincing proofs, that no, it has to be understood that way. But I just mentioned that that's a place where when Chazal said something in the Gemara, you have a slight machlokas, whether it's to be taken as a drash or as an absolute ikar, a matter of faith. But usually it's clear. Usually we have statements of Chazal that are clearly in one category or in the other. And Medrash is a harder study. Midrashim, I think we should learn and recognize that it could be a whole lifetime till we understand fully what they mean. Chazal cloaked the deepest wisdom in simple terms, and that's very often what Midrashim are. But all statements of Chazal should be taken seriously and have a very real and specific meaning. And in general, when a Chacham says something and says it as Eidos, Gavra Rabba de Kamasid, it should be taken seriously. So to conclude, I would quote, the people quote Reb Chaim Brisker, and again, I don't know if he said it or not, but I don't know if this is a Beavis Meisa or not, but it's certainly a worthwhile statement. He says, a person who believes that everything is true is a fool, but a person who believes nothing is true is an apikaris. Or as sometimes they say, if you believe it couldn't be true, you're an apikaris. But it doesn't mean that it's all true. As an important aside, it's important when being machanech children, while on the one hand, I don't think it's a good idea to make them think things that aren't meant to be literal are literal. That's dangerous. Siogle amuna shalo laham. If you make a kid think that something fantastic is literal, and he gets older and realizes it isn't literal, and then he calls everything into question, that's a dangerous practice. On the other hand, I don't think a person should be a constant naysayer. If you find yourself, no, that story about this gadol isn't true, that story is not true, but at least tell him what is true. You know, I don't need to believe that Rav Moshe Feinstein knew every sifkat in Baal Peh. Rav Moshe is greater because I understand what he was. When I work for hours and hours to understand a sugya and I can't scratch the surface the way he can plumb the depths, I don't need the story. But at least if you're going to say that something isn't true, say what is true. Present don't always be shooting things down. There's something wrong if a person is always seeking to knock things down. There's something wrong with that too. And certainly in B'machanach's children, you don't always have to be. And if there is a little bit of hyperbole, if it isn't dangerous, you can let it be. You don't have to be constantly a stickler for these things. But I do think that being as accurate as we can be is the strongest force in bolstering emunah. And I think this is really the first lesson, really, in the Chumash, the first story in the Chumash with Chava, right? And this here, the Nachash says, you can't eat anything here. Hashem said that you can't eat from all the fruits. So Chava says, no, you can, but from this eitz, you can't eat it and you can't touch it, right? So Rashi says right there, and it's a medrash, that because she embellished, because she pushed the story too far. It's not what Hashem said, so the Nachash pushed her hand and she touched it, and nothing happened because there was an inaccuracy, and then it was upgefrecht. It was shown to be not correct, and maybe Chava was even inspired to make things sound more chum, or make them sound more toward Isser, because that was the spirit that the Nachash had engendered. But it's stronger to fight Sheker with Emes, to fight Sheker with Sheker, so a person can end up being Nechshon. I think sometimes people think that a siyag le'emunah is lahamin. The safeguard to emunah is to believe everything. If you let somebody doubt something, they're going to start to doubt everything. To the contrary, if you make people believe things that later they're going to see aren't true, to believe in everything is to believe in nothing. Siyagla emuna shalola ha'amin. We have to reserve strong emuna. We have to believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, believe in Torah Mitzvahs, believe in Torah Misinai, believe in the Bias HaMashiach, believe in Tchias HaMeisim, to have a strong emuna, and believe in the Mesorah of the Torah Shebal Peh, a strong emuna in the Karim and other things. If we reserve judgment, maybe yeah, maybe no. I remember years ago, it's already a good few years ago, when I was in yeshiva, there was this story with the Dibuk in Eretz Yisrael. A Dibuk is a disembodied soul. There was a real one in the time of the Chavetz Chaim. Chavetz Chaim was there, Chanan Wasserman was there, and this disembodied soul attached itself to a girl, and the Chavetz Chaim took care of it. That was a famous story. And Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky's Sefer on Chumash, he quotes Rabbi Chanan Wasserman as having said he thinks that it probably would be the last time they would ever witness a thing like that, because as there's less supernatural things in the realm of Kedusha in the world, you see less on the other side too. It's Zel Uma Zeh Asa Elokim. It always has to be an even playing field. When there are more open miracles, or when there are more supernatural things, Letzad HaTov, good things, so you have it equaled out. But as there's a diminution, we see less of that. Anyway, a few years ago, there was a story going around in Eretz Yisrael about a Dibuk. It was very interesting. The Dibuk had political shitas, very politics. But I said there were people who wrote, no one's allowed to doubt this. This is clearly Yad Hashem. Anybody who's doubting this is... And then it came out, the woman was a ventriloquist, and there were other historic pieces. That's not Torah Misinai. Maybe yes, maybe no. Could it be? Do I believe that there are neshamas? Of course, but do I have to believe that this is a person can reserve judgment. We don't have to put emuna in things that are not ikar. Maybe yes, maybe no. But as I said, siyag le'emuna shelo lahamin, we should reserve emuna for the fully strong things. And save the Beavis Mices for the Beavis Mices, and instead of doing Be'ezer Hashem, I hope we can have a stronger, be able to resist Chalila when there's an onslaught, and we live in a world of a lot of confusion, when people challenge us, if we're strong in what we truly believe in, we can respond to that, we can be Machanech children to have strong Emunah, and Be'ezer Hashem to strengthen Emunah within Am Yisrael. Thank you.